This is a BBC Radio 6 Music documentary. Who's Who? Keith Moon.
The Who is something different to everybody. To some people, it's Tommy. To others, it's Happy Jack, my generation. To others, it's Who Sell Out. To others, it's a band that I like to go and see on stage, but I wouldn't buy their records. To some, it's I like their records, but I think they're just a load of big mouth shafts on stage. I think the band is many faceted.
Who's Who, a series in which members of The Who talk about themselves, about one another, and 10 years together. This week we hear mainly from Keith Moon, born 1947 in Wembley, London. Keith Moon, comic, prince of the absurd. Keith Moon, actor, Beach Boys freak, king of the nightclubs. Keith Moon, drummer. No doubt you'll build up your own picture of Mooney. Here with something to be going on with is Roger Daltrey.
What can you say? He was like every chick's dream drummer. He really was. He was like he was the glamour in the group. Then he went mad.
Good morning, campers. I'm your Uncle Ernie and I welcome you to Tommy's Holiday Camper. We camp with a difference. Never mind the weather. When you come to Tommy's, the holiday's forever.
Happy Jack wasn't old, but he wasn't there. He lived in the sand at the Isle of Man. The kids would all sing, he would take a rum key.
Hi, Sawyer.
I was the last one to join the band, mainly because I'm the youngest, but we all used to play in the same sort of circuit around Wembley, Shepherd's Bush, Ealing, Putney, and the Detours used to be one of the better paid bands. They used to get 12 quid. I used to play for a group called the Beachcombers and we used to get 10. It wasn't just the money, the extra 10 bob per gig that made me want to join the Detours. They were the most respected out of all of the bands. I went to see them at a place called the Oldfield in Harrow and just got up on stage. Their own drummer had left and they were just the drummer that was sitting in with them I knew. So I just said, can I play? So they said, well, I don't know, can you? So I got up and bashed about. I just bashed about and I've been doing the same ever since. They just never asked me to leave. They dropped me off at my house and said, pick you up same time tomorrow. We've got a gig at Putney. And that was it, I was in. When I first met the band, I was Bright Ginger. I dyed the barnet, and I'd been out and bought this goddamn awful sort of bright ginger suit. And it just so happened that when I first joined the band, I was wearing this thing. I mean, to come to it was horrendous. I mean, the ultimate in bad taste. But then, of course, with a round neck collar and all, it was foam backed. Terrible. If it rained, the suit stayed wet, it was like a sponge, it stayed wet for about 3 months. If you went out in the rain and it swelled, it looked like the Michelin Man.
We were playing in Greenford one night with the session driver, and this fella walked up to us and said, my mate can play better than your drummer. So we said, well, let's hear him then, bring him up. So he brought up this little gingerbread man. It was Keith with dyed ginger hair and a brown shirt, brown tie, brown suit, brown shoes, and he just looked like a little gingerbread man. And he got up on the kit and we said, can you play Roadrunner? Because we actually hadn't come across a drummer that could play Roadrunner with us. And he played Roadrunner, and we thought, oh, well, this is the fellow. He played it perfectly and it fitted in really well. And actually the first gig he actually turned up to with us was, I think it was a wedding. He turned up and he put his little blue drum kit up and then got this huge coil of rope and tied it all together, and we couldn't understand why until he went into a drum solo and everything started swaying backwards and forwards.
Tech. They started a band, and the music teacher just sort of said, well, they're doing a bit of extra curricular work, you know, on music, studying up on music, and convinced the headmaster that it was important. And they gave us a room to ourselves, and we just started a little sort of jazz group then, really. And I got my first set of drums, about 16 quid, I think. Painted, you know, a nice Chinese lacquer green, you know, just a sort of Mickey Mouse kit. Well, first, when I joined the band, I'd gone up a step and I had a sort of 30 quid kit. And they took one look at it and said, well, you know, you've got to get something a bit decent. And so that was when I first started really to get into debt. And so I went out and bought this kit that I couldn't afford. And in fact, I probably still owe the HP on it. It's about 2 quid a week, you know, for 100 years.
I told you why I changed my mind. I got bored by playing with time. I know you thought you had me nailed. Well, I freed my head from your garden.
I can't remember recording some of them. I mean, some of them we were going through, I was either drunk in charge, and I don't remember. I don't remember playing substitute at all. I'm just too stoned. And when it came out, I accused the other members of the group of getting another drummer in. It doesn't seem wild to me. I'm just clumsy, you know. I mean, things get broken and things fall into swimming pools, and it's just I'm a lousy driver, and I'm very clumsy. I mean, that's about it. I've got better at it. I've got over the years with the practice. I had lots of practice in the 10 years with you. The most particular ones I can't remember. For the same reasons I can't remember playing on substitute.
It's not true. You say I've been in prison. You say I've got a wife. You say I've had help doing everything throughout my life. It's not true. It's not true. I'm telling you. Cause I'm...
The stage fights were fairly common. One of us had either turn up late, usually me, or would be sort of, well, we just generally didn't get on all that well, and we used to take it out on stage. We used to avoid each other off stage. So the only time we really ever got together was on stage. And so all the pent-up aggression would come out then. And sometimes it just used to get to a flashpoint where instead of it being directed as it is now, we direct it toward the audience and we use it. We used to turn it back on ourselves. So we used to beat each other up on stage. And of course, this used to make for very short shows. In fact, some of the shows we did were only about 6 minutes long, and then everything used to get totaled. Because the average length of a show then was about 45 minutes. And sometimes we stayed the distance, and sometimes we just walk on, smash up the equipment and walk off. And that would be it, you know, 3 minutes and that's your lot. It wasn't until we started using that kind of energy in a positive direction that the band started to pick up and come together socially and professionally. Before that, it was a lot of it was just destruction, just for the sake of it, just because we didn't particularly like each other at that moment in time. Aaron, it was good to have a friend on stage in those days, because it could get pretty airy. Later on in career, we just all came together a bit more and stopped beating the hell out of each other. Although sometimes, now it still sort of flares up, which is only natural, you know. We're still, you know, a fairly volatile band, to say the least. Drums are the most physical and the most aggressive, but it's the way an instrument's played. I mean, Pete plays the most aggressive chords and the most aggressive guitar with attack, and I play the drums aggressively. And John plays sort of round all the aggression. The aggressiveness towards each other, the early aggression, still comes through in the music. When we're on stage, it's still... every man for himself, and if you can't take it, get out, because nobody's going to give way, and it doesn't matter what instrument you're playing. The drums certainly are the easiest to be aggressive with, because they're the most physical. You can feel fairly impotent if you're a guitarist. And the drummer, you just pull out your plug and you're playing electric guitar. I mean, it's sort of like, that's you, you know, up the creek without a paddle. It's because each of us has got our own personality, which is fairly strong. Obviously, sometimes if they clash, and nobody gives in until it's either comes to a shouting match or physical. This as well, this comes out in the music a lot. A lot of the aggression that comes in our music comes from bouncing off each other. I think if we had anybody in the band that was placid, that let themselves get pushed around, they'd be flat by now. I mean, they just would have been squashed out of existence. It's got to be fairly tough to stay in the U.
Don't go and hide. Yesterday you were my girlfriend. If you do, my cycle's around and around in the whirlwind. There's a stone in my shoe, so I can't catch you up. My head's in a lion's mouth, wants to eat me up right.
The attitude towards the audience has pretty much always been, it's always been the same in my case. I always go out with the intention of making them leave the theatre or whatever, saying, what a great drummer. I mean, that's the way I think before I go on stage. I want to please the audience. I want the audience to like what I'm doing. At the same time, I don't want to sort of bend to the audience's whim. You know, I mean, I'm not going to let the audience dominate me. I mean, if they don't like it, then they can leave. It's not so much fun if, with an audience that sits there with a dour expression and says, okay, I've paid me quid, I've paid me buttons, now entertain me. If you get that kind of audience, it's a hard graft. If you get the sort of audience that is there to have a good time, to have a night out, to become part of an event, it's much easier, much nicer to work to that kind of audience, because you're not working to it, you're working with it. I know I'm an extrovert. Yes, oh yes, I'm an extrovert. I think anybody that goes on stage is being extrovert. I love working in front of a live audience. In a studio, you get into it's like a sort of twilight thing. There's no day or night. You can work sort of around the clock at something, just on one tune. You try and recreate the kind of excitement that you feel on stage, but it's very difficult when you're stuck in a 6x4 booth with a pair of headphones and canned music. The way I play is mainly through feedback from another source. I mean, I get most of my ideas from watching the audience or from listening to the other members of the band. When you're in a studio and you're isolated from that and you're playing to nobody, at times it's difficult, but the brandy helps. Every day I get to you, to my magic bus, to get on the bus that takes me to you, to my magic bus. I'm so nervous I just sit and smile, to my magic bus. The house is only another mile. I think, I mean, if I hadn't joined The Who, I would have been in some branch of the industry, one way or another. I don't know what, but I think whatever I'd have done anyway would have been a success. I don't think it works unless you totally commit yourself to something. There's no good being half-hearted. That's why one of the main reasons why the band has succeeded is because everybody is totally committed to it. People started to say, well, look, you know, somebody's doing their solo album, or somebody's doing this, or somebody's, you know, like, Keith's gone to America. I mean, so what? It doesn't make my commitment to The Who any less. It doesn't, you know, lessen it, doesn't dilute it in any way. In actual fact, it serves to strengthen it, because I've got something else to do, instead of sitting at home just thinking, oh, when's the next Who gig, and twiddling my thumbs. You know, I'm in the studio, I'm working, I'm still working. When I said I was coming out to Los Angeles to live, people said, oh, well, that's the end of the Who. I mean, as if I'd... And it only takes 12 hours from here. I mean, I'd be back there, I'd get a phone call today, and I can do a show in Manchester the day after tomorrow. I mean, it's no sweat being in Los Angeles at all, and it's got several advantages. I don't know what people, what their image is. I suppose it's what they read, you know, it's the media image that they've got. I mean, they've got the, that's all, I mean, that's all they can have, really, apart, you know, they go to a show, they see Keith Moon flicking sticks up in the air, catching them, acting the fool behind the drums. They see any of the movies I've done, and it's Keith Moon being crazy. They read any newspaper articles, and it's me being crazy and zany or whatever. So, you know, what else can they think? Which, and I suppose it's true. The things that appear a bit sort of strange to them are perfectly normal to me. I mean, that's, I don't find anything odd in some of the things that have been written about me, but other people do. They come, they go, look at this. Nutty as a fruitcake. But I don't think it's odd at all. But, you know, it's perfectly normal. I'm probably a lot more, I don't know, a lot more, I can't say a lot more serious, because, I mean, then I laugh at that. I think I laugh at most things, really. I find most things either absurd or tragedy doesn't really, I mean, obviously it affects me in some ways, but it doesn't ever get on top of me. The times that it's come close to getting on top of me, certainly there are times when it's been very near, but I'm pretty much the same off stage as on. I lead a very active sort of social life. I spend about, say, 6 days of the week clubbing and one day recovering, one day kipping, and that's that's my sort of modus operandi of the week, you know, is that I spend either a week working, 6 days working, and the seventh rest, which is the way it should be, or the way it works for me, anyway. No, I think there's a hell of a lot of difference between me on stage and me off, really. I'm just as crazy both ways.
Once again, the sun rises over the passionate prairie, and old Mother Nature spreads the colors of her paint box before our eyes, as she has done throughout the countless millions of years since before man walked this earth. The pattern of life on the prairie has remained unchanged throughout the centuries. And every morning, old Papa Gopher pushes his nose out of his hole to sniff the morning air. Uh-oh, here comes a cougar. Don't come too close, Mr. Cougar, says old Papa Gopher. But hush, there is a stirring in the long grass. Who is this friendly little fellow?
Hello, mates. It's me, Keith Moon of the Who. No, don't move. I've got a gun. First, a word to all of you who wrote to say you caught last week's show. Keep taking the pills, give up drinking for 3 weeks, and come back on Thursday for the results of the lab tests. Now, who is this friendly little fellow?
Walt Moon, and an extract from a 1973 programme recorded for Radio 1. Not exactly one of the projects that Keith made a lot of money out of.
It's quite funny, actually, that once you sort of start making a certain amount of money, to see the sort of changes that people go through and the sort of roles they adopt. I tried to be the Ben Cartwright of Chertsey. Totally unsuccessfully. I mean, everybody left, and the garden was like a wilderness, and I mean, it was just totally unsuccessful. I think, you know, I was just destined to live in clubs and to sort of fly a jet set about. I didn't really think I was meant to have a base, which is why Los Angeles is appealing, because it, you know, in its very essence is as transitory as my nature. I mean, it's a, sort of as fly by night as me, and I can't sustain a kind of relationship. I can't see myself, you know, as a really being married, you know, and nor could my wife. Uncle Ernie was really, it came about when the London Symphony Orchestra were doing the show at the Rainbow, and Ringo had been on the Lou Reisner album as Uncle Ernie, and so when it came to the stage show, and Ringo said he didn't want to do the stage show, the load fell on me, and it said, I said, is it costume? He said, well, do whatever you like. So I've just made up the costume. You know, and Dougal, my driver, and I had great fun going up and down Charing Cross Road looking for anything in surgical pink. We spent hours, and all of that, you know, I'd be over one side, outside the lots of fun surgical shop, and Dougal would scream, there's a jockstrap in surgical pink over here. And I'd hurtle across Charing Cross Road. And eventually, you know, we had this mountain of surgical pink material, which we used for the Rainbow, and I kept it for Australia. And when I was there, when I was in Australia, we did the concert, we did two concerts there, and it was set in the place, you know, looked like a, I mean, the Australians described it, like a jewel set in the middle of a park. An absolutely wonderful example. And, you know, it's this awful sort of race course in the middle of a load of fields, you know. I mean, it was like, you know, a jewel in a wonderful setting, and it's right carsy, right, stuck in a mud flap. So we're out there, we've got two shows to do. I'm dressed up in surgical pink underneath this raincoat. Now, halfway through we did the two performances, I did the one show, and we had a break of half an hour. While the audience were going out and the new lot coming in, I'd steamed out the caravans where we were changing. And the caravans were parked near the ticket place. And I was going across, and I was running across all these mud flats. The raincoat came open, revealing all this surgical pink underwear. And I was arrested by the Melbourne police as a pervert. And I kept trying to tell them, you see. I said, well, this isn't, you know, it's not really my street clothes. None of them wanted to touch me. Just covered in mud and filth and, like, just, yeah, horrid, totally horrid. So they took me to the police van, and they had to send for the producer of the show to bail me out, you know, to say that this actually was a stage costume, and that this is not how he normally dresses. Because when I came out in what I usually wear, I was very nearly arrested again.
I'm your wicked Uncle Ernie. I'm glad you won't see or hear me as I fiddle about, fiddle about. Your mother left me here to mind you. Now I'm doing what I want to.
Uncle Ernie's song from Tommy. Obviously, a character as strong as Keith Moon's could hardly fail to make impressions on those around him. Although it isn't our intention here to analyse so complex a personality, we put together some random comments from other members of the group. First, Pete Townsend.
His enthusiasm for life, for conversation and lusty drinking is well over my limit. And so in order to be with him and be good company for Keith, you both got to go halfway. In other words, he's got to calm down a bit and you've got to freak out a bit. And the great thing about somebody like Keith, you see, is that he happens to be incredibly funny. I mean, he's incredibly entertaining bloke. So, I mean, you're never bored when you're with him, and so you never consequently think of the fact that, well, you know, maybe I don't really feel comfortable. I mean, I'm sure that a lot of people don't feel at ease with Keith Moon. But then on the other hand, he doesn't try to make people feel at ease.
Pete Townsend, and so to the thoughts of the guy who certainly in the early years was the closest to Keith, John Entwistle.
I wrote a song called Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which ended up as a B-side of one of the singles, which I wrote about Keith, who I've always considered to be two separate personalities, like two separate people, one of which I know and one of which I don't know quite so well, yeah, and sometimes try and avoid. He's seems to be like made of rubber. I mean, he bends into different shapes. You can always tell who he's been with the day before by the way he talks and the way he acts. I suppose, in a way, when we're both in the right mood, we're the most friendly of the group to each other. When we're in the right mood.
John Entwistle, the Ox. Roger Daltrey tries to sum up his feelings after 10 years with Mooney.
Keith is unbelievable. He lives a lifetime a day. He's the funniest person you could meet. And then when you get to know him, if you ever get to know him, he can also be the most tragic person. He's the most eccentric, the most generous, also probably the most selfish, in a way that only probably the Who would know about. He's the most loving, the most hateful. he really is. He's got his total opposites. He can have you in tears of laughter 1 minute and then, you know, breaking your heart the next. That's what he's like. That's Mooney. In a funny sort of way, he's a very sad sort of character. And yet in another way, he's a very happy sort of character. What can you say? I think the thing about Mooney is he'll never find his way of life in this world as we know it, I don't think. Nothing to satisfy him anyway.
Keith's theme from The Who's 1973 epic, Quadrophenia. Keith Moon, as you may have gathered, is currently living and recording in Los Angeles. There's also been some speculation as to whether other members of The Who might leave Britain, as became apparent when Keith considered the possibilities of a second decade of The Who.
Roger expressed some concern over the tax situation in England and said that he might be thinking of moving. John, the same. Pete said, and he'd remain a true blue Anglophile, he's going to stay where he was. I imagine that The Who, 10 years from now, will be working together, off and on, doing I've no idea what. 10 years from now, I'll be nearly 40. How am I going to get a wheelchair down the stairs at a whiskey?
Six music. Six music. Six music.